Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. So New York City sanitation workers are out plowing the plantation. At least that's how you might put together their big job today, with the remark made at the de Blasio inaugural by Sanitation Department Chaplain Fred Lucas. Reverend Lucas was one of four city chaplains to deliver invocations. And as you probably know, he has gotten much blowing and drifting aimed back at him for saying this.
Oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God, end the civil wars and usher in a new reconstruction era that builds upon the many successes and achievements of yesterday, while proclaiming the beginning of a new beginning. Let the plantation called New York City be the city of God, a city set upon the hill, a light shining in darkness.
The plantation called New York City, said Reverend Lucas, which offended many people. And one of those offended by the remark was outgoing New York Times columnist Clyde Haberman, who tweeted his disapproval and stated it on New York One that night. So we'll talk now about the first firestorm of the de Blasio era, as well as the first snowstorm of the de Blasio era, and also take some time for a broader view as Clyde Haberman leaves the Times this week after 37 years. I invited him on as he was interviewing me for his column last month after I learned that it would be his last. Hi, Clyde. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And let's jump right in on the inaugural to begin. Why did you react to Reverend Lucas's remark?
Well, for one thing, I have an instinctive distaste for invocations of slavery references for any misfortune that may befall African Americans these days. I have the very same reaction to invocations of the Holocaust that some Jews do whenever there's something that goes wrong vis-a-vis Israel and whatever. These should be very carefully chosen words. And I, you know, Reverend Lucas is the chaplain, as you notice, of the sanitation department. I wonder how many sanitation workers who are busting their backs out there this morning feel that they're shoveling out at the plantation. I doubt very many. It was offensive in the extreme. And I have to say, a little disturbing that when Mayor de Blasio was asked about this line specifically at a news conference yesterday, he said that he was very comfortable with the way things went. And if I were he, I wouldn't feel very comfortable with this kind of notion.
I could argue that this is no big deal, that so many things are still so unequal along racial lines in New York. Look at incomes, unemployment rates, graduation rates, and more. You know these stats. That plantation doesn't have to be taken literally to mean slavery or the old plantation system per se, but just to make a provocative point about the savage inequalities that still exist here in 2014.
I'm all in favor of metaphors, but not all metaphors are equal. And when you invoke civil wars, as he did, when you invoke the word shackles, when you invoke plantation, you're creating a metaphor that is certainly, for many New Yorkers, at the very least harsh. And if that's the intention, of course, that is the intention. Sanitation might want to ask itself if indeed that this is the kinds of blessings that it wants from its chaplain.
I didn't even know, by the way, I guess I should have known, that the city services departments, I guess it was a sanitation chaplain, a police chaplain, a fire chaplain, and what was the fourth one?
Corrections, I believe.
Yeah, so I didn't know they had chaplains. Are they on the payroll? Is this a church and state issue?
Yeah, I don't know this. Well, you know, look.
Ceremonial positions?
For the most part, I suspect it is. And if anybody needs the grace of whatever supreme being may exist, it would be sanitation workers. They actually have the most dangerous job in the city. All our hearts always usually go out to firefighters and policemen, and that's quite true. But the folks who get hurt the most day in, day out, lifting A, just the tonnage that they lift, and B, God only knows what's inside some of those trash bags, that they have a very dangerous job.
And I thought it was a good gesture on the part of Mayor de Blasio to make this first appearance this morning at a sanitation facility in Woodside, Queens. So he, as well as probably a political move because they supported him and he has to negotiate a contract with him, but also a nice gesture to pay homage to them as he touts how well the streets are being cleared.
He does, and he also has to show that a progressive can indeed clear the streets and pick up the garbage and keep things straight. That's going to be one of his challenges, of course, is to allay concerns that some have that his emphasis is going to be so heavily on social inequality, which is obviously a huge problem and even a defining problem of our day, but that indeed, as he himself said in his remarks over the last few days, his main job is to keep the city functioning.
Were you able to see or hear his remarks from Woodside as you were waiting to come on?
I did.
Any impressions there as he was doing what was, you know, not a right-left action, but as you were describing,
it was fine.
Running the city.
It was fine. I mean, he told us it was cold a few more times than I think was absolutely necessary. And at some point, I think we can all take a break from whatever Dante's doing today. But that's a personal matter.
There will be a moment where Bill and Dante de Blasio meet Cory Booker in the middle of the George Washington Bridge as they each do their requisite shoveling.
Or racing into a house to save somebody whose house is on fire.
All right. Okay. Bigger picture. You wrote a Metro Section column for The Times beginning in 95. And am I right that you were the Metro editor for the paper at one point as well?
No.
You didn't do that?
No, never was. They very wisely kept me out of management.
So still with that long view, how do you see the rise of the explicit progressive Bill de Blasio? Is it part of a cycle of political swings? Is it kind of a return to normalcy, to quote a long-forgotten president, after the emergencies of recession and crime and 9/11 that kind of gave rise to Bloomberg and Giuliani?
Look, pendulums by definition swing, and this one has finally swung. And it's I think it was almost inevitable that somebody on the liberal to left side of the spectrum was going to be elected mayor. And Mr. de Blasio, with a very savvy campaign, caught that pendulum and swung it all the way in a way that almost as progressive, if not even more so, John Liu was probably to the left of de Blasio, couldn't do for all sorts of reasons. I think it helps the new mayor, the fact that despite inequality and despite concerns that were articulated at the inaugural, that by and large, the city is running fairly well. And at least half of New Yorkers in the last New York Times poll on this issue agree. And that makes it easier for people to vote for somebody like Bill de Blasio than it would be if we still had 2,200 murders a year and if we had graffiti everywhere and a sense of social decay. We don't have that. It's a safer time, let's say, for people to vote this way. The only thing that I would urge, even though he does have almost three quarters of the vote, and I firmly believe in the Woody Allen line that 80% or 90%, whatever figure you use, of life is about showing up, and elections are decided by those who indeed go to the polls. Nonetheless, only 24% of us, our registered voters, did vote, and it might be a useful note of humility to remember that he got three quarters of that 24%, and we can't 100% discern what that other 76% is thinking. They're not all Joe Lota voters, I know that, but they may not necessarily feel the same passion.
And he's got something to prove, being new in the office, and time will tell if he proves it. You sent me an interesting email listing some pet peeves about the city. In addition to the big obvious issues that the mayor has to address, like affordable housing and education and public safety, you acknowledged obviously that's where he has to put most of his energy. But things like sidewalk sheds that get left up when they're supposed to be temporary and how loud sirens are on the city's emergency vehicles. Want to take that one? Sirens are too loud?
Well, they definitely are. I mean, if you go to Europe and other places, they're not nearly as loud. The sidewalk sheds, or scaffolding, as some people call them, not quite accurately, are a pet peeve of mine. They leave the city ugly beyond words. And there is the physical look of the city is very important. Obviously, the other issues you mentioned about housing and education and crime and so on are the big issues. I don't expect the mayor to drop everything for sidewalk sheds, as though he may drop everything for horses in Central Park. But but the
and we'll see if he follows through with that promise to abolish horse carriage trade.
Landlords have been, in many cases, just allowed to leave these things up for years on end in many cases. I would also make an argument, another small bore issue, but an important one symbolically. Mayor Bloomberg voided a deal that the Giuliani administration had made to give the Tweed Courthouse, which is a glorious building, redone at a huge municipal expense, also a great symbol of municipal corruption of the 19th century, as we all know. And the deal was to give that glorious building to the Museum of the City of New York. Mayor Bloomberg virtually on day one voided that deal because he wanted to make the gesture that Tweed Courthouse right behind City Hall will be right under his nose, and he gave it to the Department of Education. Education bureaucrats or any bureaucrats can put their coffee mugs down anywhere in any kind of building. They don't need this. I don't know if it's too late for the Museum of the City of New York to get it, but that building should be returned to public use.
Mayor Bloomberg wanted it to be a symbol of the centrality of education.
But that's a vanity project on his part, and it deprived the public of this city of a municipal treasure.
So, listeners, let's take a few minutes along these lines. We know what the A-list is of big issues the new mayor has to tackle: criminal justice, housing, education, etc. What's on your B-list? What are your other quality-of-life pet peeves that the city should do something about? You just heard some of Clyde Haberman's. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Anything you would add to this list? Anything, as you hear Clyde talk about sidewalk sheds or the use of the Tweed Courthouse or how loud the sirens are on emergency vehicles in New York City, that you would add to things sort of like that that you hope also get onto the new mayor's plate? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Are sirens louder here than they are in other cities?
I think they are. You know,
life is louder here than.
Well, that is true, and so maybe you need louder sirens than you might in other places. I was also struck on this. One of my subjects in that Breaking Bread series of interviews that I did, you being the last one, was with Jan Eliasson, who's the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, and I talked about diplomatic life in New York was the focus of the conversation, and asked him about his pet peeves, and he said sirens are unbelievable. He lives, you know, a rather gilded life, high up in a building not far from the UN, and he says he's awakened almost every night by these sirens roaring through. I don't expect anybody to feel great sympathy necessarily for Mr. Eliasson, but he hit on a reasonable point. They're really loud.
Ed in Manhattan has one, I think. Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Yes, Brian, thank you. I want to thank Mr. Haberman. I didn't always agree with his politics, but his columns were terrific, and he will be missed. I want to bring a real old one to the fore. I'm old enough to remember when John Lindsay promised us portable toilets. Now, of course, we can always count on Starbucks, but you know the Starbucks are increasingly mobbed because of all these tourists. So I think it's caught up in litigation. Will I live to see the portable toilets program institutionalized, at least in Manhattan?
Well, that's a good one. And thank you for your kind words.
What does that mean? Like port-a-sands everywhere?
No, I assume that the gentleman's talking about public toilets. that many other cities have. We've experimented. There was one in Herald Square, I know, and a few other places. And we never seem to be able to get off the ground on this. Somebody did a booklet a few years ago called Where to Go in New York. And
I remember that. That was kind of pre-Starbucks, wasn't it? Or the proliferation of Starbucks.
I would also say Barnes & Noble, perhaps, but now Barnes & Noble's are going out of business because of e-books. So e-books are going to be the menace for us in terms of where to go.
Or if not going out of business, there certainly aren't Barnes & Nobles in as many places as there were. All right. Andrew has one, too. Andrew, you're on the Upper East Side, right?
Yes, I am.
And?
Hi. I'd like to mention about alternate side parking. I think it should go down to once a week. A lot of people are sitting in their cars doing nothing, burning a lot of gas. Could add to our economy just by getting out of their car and working. And maybe just like doubling up the street sweepers on those days, because lots of times the street sweeper doesn't even come by. So we're sitting in our car for nothing.
I can testify to the fact that there are lots of idling cars, or at least people sitting in their cars in those last few minutes before the the time changes on that. Because we once did a call-in only for people who were waiting for alternate side of the street to change at 11 a.m.
That's me.
And in those 20 minutes from 10:40 to 11 o'clock that day, we had no shortage of people calling from their cars. So, Clyde, how did they come up with this? Have you ever looked into it? I know where I live in Upper Manhattan, the number of alternate side of the street parking days has been reduced recently. It used to be three on a lot of streets.
That's
now it's
true.
One on a lot of streets.
That's true pretty much all over the city.
Yeah.
On one level, they continually find new holidays on which to suspend alternate side of the street parking. The way the way we honor various groups in our city is to leave the streets dirty to celebrate them. So, and a lot of it is Me Too-ism. Some of it were the obvious holidays like 4th of July, Christmas, New Year's. And then it was quite clear that a lot of Orthodox Jews who formed a large share of the city could not drive on certain holidays. And then Me Too-ism kicked in. And so we now have holidays suspended for the various Islamic Eids, for various Catholic holidays, Diwali now, the Hindu holiday. I'm waiting for the Zoroastrians to kick in with their desire. So,
but those are the exception. I get the humor in that, but those are the exceptions, right?
They are. And although you can go, depending on the month, you can go all of October practically without the streets being swept because
all the
Jewish holidays keep coming up. And Jewish holidays, we know, never are on time. They're always either early or late. And frankly, I would charge people for being able to park on the streets. I don't know why this is one piece of personal property that you're allowed to leave out there. I once did a column in which I raised a question of, if I'm willing to accept the threat of theft, how about if I have an extra bureau of drawers that I have no space for in my apartment? Can I just put it on wheels and leave it out on the street and, of course, move it every time the alternate side requires? And, of course, people would say, you're crazy. You can't do that. But why can I do that then with something called a motor vehicle?
And it could be, in all seriousness, that with Mayor de Blasio's promised progressivism toward streets, cars, and other vehicles, that it is going to get more expensive to park on the streets, even for residents.
Maybe. And I know there'll be a lot of yelling about this. But, in fact, the more that we can encourage people not to use cars, the better we all are. I have occasionally over the years done a marathon column in which I drive the marathon route. I'm always slower than hundreds of the runners because of the traffic. And it is always an eye-opener for me. I don't drive in the city usually. To go across the Queensboro Bridge, now the Ed Koch Queensboro Bridge, and virtually everybody on that bridge is a one-person car. And there's got to be a way to finally end this. I can't believe that all those people absolutely need to drive.
By the way, Mayor de Blasio did mention in his snow report earlier that the few places that have alternate side of the street parking on Saturdays will have it suspended tomorrow for continued snow removal. So just passing that along. Let's take one more. Nick in Weehawken, but you work in the city, right?
That is correct. I work on Broadway. and have learned the joys of trying to navigate on foot in Midtown. And I wanted to piggyback on the sidewalk shed issue and suggest that payphones, which hardly anyone uses, be shifted off the corner to the sides, to the side streets, and maybe spray paint artists who I'm glad that they're out there making money, but sometimes they've put themselves in choke points. It would just be nice to maybe have a city designer occasionally try to walk through Midtown up and down the avenues and take note of where these choke points are, because there are times when you've got basically the width of two people to walk, and no wonder people occasionally will step into the bicycle paths, because sometimes that's the only way you can move faster than a slow shuffle.
That's a very good point. Thank you for raising it. You raise actually the broader issue of what is often called sidewalk furniture and the degree that these are impediments for free flow of pedestrians. I would throw in there the newspaper honor boxes that line many sidewalks in the street, including those from my own former newspaper. The courts have ruled that they're protected by the First Amendment. I frankly have never fully understood those rulings, because this deals with the commerce of the newspapers, not the content. And I wouldn't mind greater regulation. I have had the lawyers for the Times express their dismay at my opinion from time to time. But I do feel that, and especially when you get things like the Learning Network and other things like that, they are impediments to free flow of pedestrians.
And Nick, thank you for your call. Outgoing New York Times columnist Clyde Haberman, my guest. And we have just a few minutes left. This is a little shorter than we originally scheduled it because of the snow coverage that we had to do with the mayor. But it's not every day that someone whose columns and bylines many of our listeners have seen frequently leaves the New York Times after 37 years. You were on the city beat much of that time, but you were also a foreign correspondent. You covered the Middle East, Tokyo, Rome, some of the fall of communism. Were you in Eastern Europe in 1989, 25 years ago now, when that all came apart?
I was. I was in Bulgaria and Romania, not the nicest places on earth, especially Romania then. I was there for the fall of Ceausescu.
This program was just beginning that fall, and it was exhilarating enough just being in the studio to watch freedom break out in country after country with almost no violence. What was it like seeing it in person?
It was exhilarating. There's no question about it. Exhilarating at the same time that you you just had the sense of this could go terribly, terribly wrong. Again, Romania was particularly striking. It had really no deep roots of democratic yearnings. It had this vicious communist rule to Nicolae Ceausescu and his wife Elena. And before that, before the communists took over, it was one of the more vicious Nazi sympathizing countries in Eastern Europe. You know, these things don't always go right, even if nominally people can vote. I felt the same concern covering the Philippines and overthrow of Ferdinand Marcos in the so-called People Power Revolution 3 years earlier. And that was as exhilarating a story as I've ever covered. But even as in that exhilaration, there was a feeling of, you know, this can go awfully wrong because folks are not fully prepared for so much of what goes into making of a civil society. We're seeing it in Iraq. We're seeing it in all across the Arab world, including the countries that were most affected by the so-called Arab Spring. And now we have Egypt, for example, basically is rolled back to Mubarak era.
And we'll be doing some segments on the show this week on the former communist bloc 25 years later. And how is democracy working? How is capitalism working in some of those countries? And when were you in the Middle East? You were based in Jerusalem for a while.
I was based in Jerusalem from 91 to 95. So I was there for what, for me anyway, and many people, not everybody, one of your listeners will agree with this characterization, was a hopeful period. I made a mistake of judgment, as others did, when the so-called Oslo agreements were signed by Israel and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, basically recognizing Palestinian rights to a state and creating the start of it in, at first, the Gaza Strip and Jericho, a tiny little town in the West Bank, that I had thought that the most important part, the psychological part had been broken through. Yes, there would be many difficult details to hammer out, but that part of recognizing that neither side is going away and they have to figure out how to live with each other in a postage stamp size space, that had been done. I am not persuaded anymore that that was the case. I am very pessimistic about that situation.
Did you find through the years that the same reporting skills were needed for covering the city and reporting from other countries, or unique reporting skills for each?
I think you need more language skills in New York, given. But a lot of it is very much the same. But the difference between covering the city is you don't have to explain a lot of things necessarily to a local audience that hopefully understands much of what you're writing about instinctively. You have to have a few more explainer paragraphs, if you will, from abroad. And you need to think on two different planes. You have to think as to how the folks in the country you're covering are thinking, but you also have to think of what do they care about back in the Bronx, where I'm from.
Now, you'll still be affiliated with the Times, I gather, on their weekly New York One show, New York Times Close Up?
That is the plan right now, and there is the desire expressed for me to contribute as a freelancer on occasion. So I guess I can call myself contributing writer and not stretch the truth too much.
And last thing, then, are you optimistic about the future of journalism? There's been this whole shakeout in recent years, as you know, as everyone knows. But maybe the tide is turning and real news organizations with real reporting like the Times are figuring out how to make enough money in the digital era to support professional reporting. Do you think?
I hope so. You know, the Times website charging for it has gone fairly well as far as I can tell. And that basically means that people recognize that to get quality journalism, you have to pay a bit for it because what the Times does costs a ton of money. All this notion of information is free, blah, blah, blah. I never bought it because it costs a fortune to provide the kind of stuff that the Times does. And you could see now with the online subscriptions a certain attitude that was very similar to 1989, as you were talking about. My memory is right. Time circulation jumped daily from roughly a million readers to 1.2 million readers that one year because people, yes, they could see the fall of the Berlin Wall on CNN, but they knew there was more going on there. This was a huge world epic development, and they went to a place that can give them the analysis.
Clyde Haberman, leaving the New York Times after 37 years, may show up there from time to time as a contributor, he says, and here from time to time as a contributing guest, I hope, as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up still, should Edward Snowden get whistleblower protection if he returns to the United States? New arguments that he should from the left and the right. And Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark goes dark on Broadway tomorrow. We'll review its expensive and troubled history with Spider-Man playwright Glenn Berger. Stay with us.